Welcome again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations, Season 9. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Squepakulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Squepmik people, and we in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, to some people, issues around food, its growing and production, its quality, its distribution and consumption would seem to be a matter fairly free of political overtones. But nothing could be further from the truth. How a society values food and the people who grow and harvest it is, in many ways, a measure of how cohesive and secure a community really is. But plant or animal food can't talk, and so we humans have to try and understand it and speak for it and about it. Because food is essential for our survival and the survival of all living entities, we can't avoid doing so. Today on Food Conversations, we have two guests who have done a lot of thinking about the social role of food and the political side of food production, which inevitably means thinking about the land on which food is grown and how we treat that land and how we share it and cherish it for its fundamental role and keeping us and future generations alive and healthy. Brian McIsaac and Rebecca Neen are the owners of Cranach Ales and Left Field Farm, land on which organic craft beer, Irish and more, is brewed and organic food, including their own hops, is grown. The products of their labors, both liquid and solid, are well known and highly esteemed in this part of the world, but besides working hard, both of them have also done considerable reflection for many years on the meaning of what they do on a daily basis, and that's what we're going to talk about today. A warm welcome, Rebecca and Brian, to Food Conversations.
Thank you. We're really glad to be here.
Good morning to you, Warren, and the rest of our listening area.
The hundreds of millions of people listening to this show. We hope one day, maybe. Now, you two first met when you were both doing what I think Rebecca called frontline social work. Brian, you were working with what we used to call mentally handicapped and with strong roots in Irish culture and society. By the way, that was England's first colony, for those who haven't read their history books. Rebecca was working with various nonprofit organizations and had parents, Kathleen and Brewster Neen, both prominent Canadian activists on social and especially food issues, to start her off in her life. You were among actually the first guests at nearly 4 years ago on Food Conversations. So let's start with this wonderful story of how the two of you got together. There was a book involved. I will say the first couple of words, bury my
heart at Wounded Knee.
Thank you, Brian. And I was going to let you, last time Rebecca told the story, but I wonder if you could tell the story this time, what it was like with this slightly manipulative exercise that took place.
That was a really good stalking experience. It was kind of cool because we were mutually stalking each other for sure. But this one particular thing that happened was we used to have a favorite place that we used to go to, my mates and me, for breakfast on a regular basis. And it was a really good little humble cafe that took us away from a lot of things that was happening in that city in East Vancouver. And I was there, and then there's this wonderful looking woman who I saw, and I'd been trying to figure out how to, I guess, meet that woman. And she was reading this really great book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. I should actually let Rebecca explain why.
Yeah, so this was part of the stalking thing. we knew that we'd all ate breakfast at the same kind of place. And I had been thinking, how do I get to meet this guy? And I thought, I know, I'm going to show up reading something slightly obscure and very political, make sure he can see the title, and see what he does. And it'll be a little test, right? Like, is he the guy for me? Does he know what's going on? And so I sat there. I picked a spot where he could not fail to read the cover of my book. And lo and behold, he came over. And not only did he recognize the book, we actually managed to have a reasonably intelligent conversation through my drool. That was pretty much that. Like, it
game
was
over.
Yeah.
It's game over. Well, I think of the most ingenious ways people can meet and get together. And this is up there in the higher echelon, no question about it.
It beats Tinder hollow, I gotta say.
Now, Karl Marx wrote, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. Now, Marx wrote it, but in a 1987 survey in the Washington Post, it was found that about 50% of Americans believed it was in the U.S. Constitution. It's actually in the 1936 Constitution of the former Soviet Union, the USSR, and also, interestingly, in various places, in part, in the Old and New Testament of the Bible. So I think it really boils down to the fact that that's a really good idea, from each according to their ability to each according to their needs. Now, why don't each of you kind of give your thoughts about that statement and that fundamental principle and how it relates to food in particular? Rebecca?
Sure. I think the bottom line is that the way currently that we have organized our food system is not based on need, it is based on profit. It is based on few people or few corporations controlling the means of production, and essentially the rest of us are victims. The concept of actual sharing of production has disappeared completely from our food system. We no longer hold land in common. In fact, we have a myth about what happens when people hold land in common. We no longer actually freely share. And this is one of those basic ideals that we find repeated over and over in indigenous culture of this locality, which is the basic concept of reciprocity.
Yes, it is a basic and very much indigenous teaching.
Yes, and not only that, but it's the one that we have access to right now to mm-hmm. reteach us the lesson that we, as humans, have learned over and over, which is that we need to take care of the land that we occupy. We need to live in relationship to that land. And when excessive financialization gets in between us and our relationship to the land, we no longer have that relationship. Our relationship becomes a relationship to money and not to soil.
An inert intermediary.
Indeed.
Brian, what would you like to add to that?
I think that the idea that we've always practiced death as a business, as a farm, that we would only take enough, and it's our share of things, make sure that we're actually sharing all the resources instead of hoarding for individual profit gain. I think mm-hmm. that's really important, that we're really pushing that idea that, it's to the concept of enough in Gaelic is it's called galore, and on this side of the water, it's galore is now meaning bounty, and it's not that. It's to have enough is just amazing. That's where you want to be, mm-hmm. and again, you want to only just take your share of things and not overdo it.
Yeah, as an exercise, I look through all the major religious traditions in the world. You know, Confucianism, Christianity, Hinduism, Judaism, and they all say the same thing. It's nice to have enough for yourself and your friends and family, and then the rest of it goes out there. It goes out there to do good in the world.
We actually have a phrase in our family that I believe my dad coined, and it says, feed the family, share the leftovers.
Well, having eaten once at your table, I would say the leftovers are pretty good. I enjoyed them a lot. There was no problem with that. Now, one place where people go and share not just food, but they also share time and a certain conviviality is the pub, the public house. And public houses exist on both sides of the Atlantic and probably in every culture around the world. And interestingly, the concept of a place where you go and have a modest amount of alcohol and sit with your friends and discuss the affairs of the day is a central feature in the Blue Zones research, which is now under the auspices of the National Geographic Society, which is a body of research that looks for communities where people live longer, healthier lives than on average. Brian, as an Irishman living on this side of the Atlantic, what do you have to say about the pub and its role in, you know, bringing people together?
Well, it's really interesting because this particular impetus came from this notion of dry January and such. So I thought, hey, hold on, a trend can't take away my culture and my rituals, and understanding what pub culture is versus bar culture. It's a place where people have ritual. They have some alcohol to kind of soothe the rough edges of conversation, and I think that to not have this place of gossip, this place of networking, is taking away from the particular culture. And I wanted to get mad at something when this happened, but I wasn't sure who I would get mad to. And I said, well, no, it's just the sense of where things have been going, pushing away from what pub culture really is, and having what I called having bars do shaking the chains of rot of capitalism, because they're just trying to get so many bums in the seats, and they're trying to establish a bit of commerce instead of
which is a nice way of saying making community. Money.
Yeah, just and it actually serves a point in community. And if you don't have an extension of your living room outside, you would never get together with people and talk about things what happening and ferment revolution, things like that.
I think your point about the public living room is really important, actually.
Because a living room is in your home and it's relaxed. Nobody's putting on pretentious.
Exactly. And it's also a place that you come to at any time. It's not a schedule. There's no rigidity to it. It is there for you. You come, you show up, other people come, you have conversation. There's whatever else involved, you know, food, drink of any description. You're comfortable. And in that comfort is the genesis of good relationships. And I think that
in that comfort is the genesis of good relations. I think that's a very a slogan over the door somewhere.
As a t-shirt.
Yeah. I remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Brian McIsaac and Rebecca Neen, the owners of Cronoak Ales and Leftfield Farm. Now, this January, in January 29th, you had a celebratory pub at the Ricochet, the local downtown watering hole. Which was very successful in terms of numbers and conviviality and all that kind of stuff. Rebecca, describe the celebration, what it was all about.
Well, it was our 25th anniversary of the brewery on the very day on which we opened. But we thought we'd bring it inside this year because it was really cold when we first, the first two times we celebrated our opening and our 10th anniversary. And we thought maybe we wouldn't freeze people.
What did it feel like to have a quarter century of operations for you?
Oh, geez. Thanks for saying quarter century. Now it feels super long. It feels like we actually got some stability and have been around long enough to be able to do something more than, again, just make beer, but to actually to look around that room and to see the community that has surrounded the brewery over the years and that to see people that we've affected in that way was incredibly moving. It was also an opportunity for us to recognize and thank people. And we didn't thank anywhere near enough people, I gotta say. But to thank people for what they have done, because again, without that community, we would absolutely not have survived because we don't operate in a traditional capitalist model.
Also, I'd like to say too that where it was at Ricochet was a telling point, because we were trying to work with a community of the culture of craft brew and things. And we say, well, look, if we do it this, we start the 25 years with a collegial kind of way of doing things. We're working with community, and our community involves other brewers as well and other like-minded things. So we wanted to make sure that we made that connection. And because people say, why'd you do it at Ricochet? Says, well, because they're our friends, and we work with community. And that's the point.
And there's something about community that's important, and that's kind of a fluidity. It's not sort of a fixed thing. You draw the lines and say, you're on that side, we're on this side. It changes all the time as people come and go, and lives change and evolve. That's something that you would, over the 25 years, have seen. You would have seen these relationships build and develop and, you know, multiply, and then people move away, you know, you maybe don't see them again. Mm-hmm. Was that kind of, there's a certain charm to that, is there not?
Oh, there is. And there's also, there's the mobility and the growth and changing. There's also the fact that we've got customers now that we first met when they were 8 years old. Not as our customers. I mean, their parents were our customers.
I was
going
to say,
yeah.
you little 8-year-old, take that bottle of beer and drink it all down. Your mother said to you.
Children-sized portions. Yeah.
They're usually very good at carrying the bottles, not necessarily doing anything else. But it's really wonderful to see that continuity, but also that changing and shifting and the evolution of a community.
Yeah, there is an evolution in all of our lives, and it's nice to see it unfolding. It gives you a sense of not just continuity, but also, don't worry, there'll be another phase. We're here now. It'll change. If it's a bad day, there'll be a good day. If it's a really good day, don't hang on to it, because tomorrow could be a little different. Now, community values and cohesion, which is what the pub is sort of an emblem of, are very important. But so is our relationship to the land. The land doesn't come to the pub and have a conversation with us, but it's all around us. And this importance of land is something that our Indigenous friends and neighbors have been trying to teach us for centuries, frankly. Mm-hmm. And we've been, you know, firmly opposed to that teaching until it's finally started to mess up the entire planet. That's got us thinking a little bit more. So let's talk a little bit about land tenure, the relationship with land, the silent but eloquent partner that we have in everything to do with food, and ownership. Tenure, ownership, they're not always the same thing. Brian, what would you say characterizes the kind of relationship with the land that is important and valuable and proper?
I think part of it, this Western notion of improving the land, is something that we really need to get away from, and the notion of winning the land is something that we really need to get away from and say, okay, it has its own intrinsic value for sure. If there's some problems that are happening with it, and it's largely our doing that's happened that way, we have a responsibility and duty of care to that land that we have. So when we come to it, we cannot denigrate it. We cannot at least have less impact on it and have it so it will continue in perpetuity and let its own cadence take over.
I think the base problem is the concept of ownership. Mm-hmm. Because ownership is, by definition, segregation. Mm-hmm. It is taking something away from the whole and accruing it to oneself, mm-hmm. however you define yourself. It could be, you know, corporate or whatever. But it is intrinsically removing, in this case, land from its context and saying this little patch of, say, our 10 acres is somehow now segregated and separated from everything else. And our responsibility, if we have any responsibility to the land, it's only to this little bit. Mm-hmm. And a more destructive concept I find difficult to imagine.
And it's also and Brian, you were alluding to this, it's a collaborative engagement. It's a if you see the land, some parts of the land or some elements in the ecosystem or your growing fields in some kind of difficulty, you're there to try to help out, not to take what you want and expect the land to take care of itself. If you do have a relationship at all, it's a collaborative one where you try and insert your own presence.
Yeah, and I would even go a step further that it's not collaborative, but it's cooperative. Those things mean different things. One, I mean, you know, the whole idea that all collaborators should be shot.
Yeah.
But the idea of cooperation, it means something more. It means that you're not just working with to a common project end, but it's actually just living with and saying, okay, it doesn't have to go somewhere. It just has to be living with each other and the land being part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so concepts of tenure that don't involve ownership, that are more involved with retaining a relationship with a particular area, establish that relationship in a whole different context. If your relationship is, or your tenure of the land is based on what you do and how you relate to the land, not to the fact that your grandfather did something, then it puts it back in that concept of relational responsibility. Yeah.
Mary Thomas, the revered elder in the Shkwepik community here, tells a story when she was a little girl of going out on the land to harvest fiddlehead ferns. And they'd been going there, you know, the phrase is from time immemorial. I love the phrase. They'd been going there for a long, long time to do this. And then one day they came up against a fence. And there was somebody standing near the fence saying, "You can't come any further. This is our property." And I think it's a tribute to the resilience of Indigenous culture that they didn't just either start a fight or make a huge fuss. They watched. They said these people seem to be very serious about what they think is right. We've got to find out more. And it's taken us, you know, hundreds of years to work out a better relationship. But the astonishment of having a fence, a structure saying you can't cross this line because it's now sequestered in our space and has nothing to do with it. Brian, can you either of you imagine what that must have been like?
Well, it's not that long ago. I mean, we have neocolonialists being Sun Peaks. That's really close to us, and that's a really good living memory on what's actually happened. A repeat of the playbook of colonialism that we come across all the time.
Yeah, it's something. Colonialism and capitalism are basically twin children, and I think they're children. I think they need to grow up.
Yes, it's definitely an infantile concept.
You have kind of incorporated a certain cooperative structure in the way you got the buildings and the humans living on your property. Why don't you describe that a little bit, Rebecca?
Well, our basic mode of operation on the farm end of things is that people who are living on the farm are involved in the production. It's not about production. That word trips me up all the time.
Producing.
In growing, in raising food, in taking care of the land. And as long as you're involved in that caretaking and participating in the processes of the land, then you also get to eat from the land. We work with the Working Group on Indigenous Food Sovereignty. They have a headquarters for the time being while they're building at Coquitlam Gardens and at the farm. And we also have other people staying there. And everybody is to some extent involved in the farm and then again, like feeding themselves. And we grow hops for the brewery, but we also grow a lot of other food, and that food is shared with the people on the farm but also with the wider community.
It's interesting. I was just listening to a podcast about the sudden bursting forth of the Chinese economy in the 1980s, and what they did was they said, we're going to base food and agriculture on households, and we're going to tell every household you have to produce a certain amount at a modest recompense. But everything you produce beyond that, you can sell into the market. And it's I mean, but it started with this household basis. I mean, what an extraordinary thing. When you think of macroeconomics and people sweeping away whole communities out of, you know, some kind of policy. And that was one of the reasons why the Chinese economy has done so well. It's been based, this core is on households as mm-hmm. the producers of, in this case, food. Brian, do you sense that, well, I sense is listening to what you're saying, that there's this kind of continuity between the relationship with the land and your relationship with one another in the space that you guys collectively occupy.
I would just want to go a little off track, not really, but this whole thing in the media and a lot of discourse around is talking about for that food production thing. They say, well, we got to make sure that we compensate people for what they do. I go, no, there's not a penalty. It's remuneration that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about compensation. Mm-hmm. We're talking about valuing what people do.
I think I get the point. We all have to live and we all have to have enough resources to make our lives reasonable. And if somebody's part of the community on your land, then they receive whatever they need to live as, you know.
Well, it's basically food security we're talking about. Say, mm-hmm. well, you should be responsible for a certain responsibility for your own sustenance, for sure. Mm. And I think that if people look at that and have a better relationship on where their food actually come from, we have a saying where you don't buy meat on styrofoam, you buy it from the butcher, mm-hmm. or you buy it from your own, or get it from your own place, mm-hmm. Raise your own chickens, raise your own sheep. And a little while ago, we had our own pigs. And so that was one of those things. So we don't actually want to buy things extra retail. We should be more involved in and have relationships in what I call the village, the butcher being one of them, or the farmer being one of the people that you interact with. And that's how you create a village.
Remind listeners once again that we have in the studio Brian McIsaac and Rebecca Neen, the owners of Cranock Ales and Leftfield Farm. Now, one little wrench that's been tossed into the work that we're talking about now is the fact that we've disrupted the climate of planet Earth through the system, I think, essentially, of capitalism and colonialism. I think that's fairly widely accepted. And it's bringing with it extreme weather events. And in growing food or facilitating the growth of food, I don't know which one of you said when we were talking before, one bad season away from losing the farm. Every farmer's nightmare is given the way we do things. And it applies to foragers and every other form of food, obtaining food. The specter of in the monetized system is that a bad season means you suddenly have a giant pile of indebtedness because all of the costs you have not disappeared, and the earnings that you had to bring into the financial economy have evaporated. Why don't you talk a little bit, Brian, about debt, about what it does to social cohesion and how it's disruptive of community?
I'm not sure if I should pass that along to Rebecca.
It's highly legal to do that.
We're not going off the board too far.
No.
I think most of Western society lives with an unholy amount of debt. We both urban people and rural people generally live one paycheck away, as you said. In farm terms, that's one season. Mm. Away from losing everything. And that debt drives us to behave in ways that we would not otherwise behave. It engenders a base level of fear. And I think it actually strengthens the internalization of capitalism in a lot of ways. It can go either way, right? You can either say, right, the only way to succeed in this is to compete with everyone else, to make all of our relationships about competition and winning and trying desperately to scrabble as hard as we can to get a toehold on something that feels a little bit secure. Or we can say, this isn't working. And you're in trouble and I'm in trouble. And maybe if we share this one loaf of bread that we have, we can actually both have some sandwiches. Right. And I think there's a lot of forces that have been pushing us in a lot of ways to internalize the capitalist model, mm-hmm. to internalize mm-hmm. this competitive model. And I think that's actually key to one of the most destructive mm-hmm. issues that we've got.
All this idea, you know, community on the one hand and separative behavior or thoughts or feelings on the other. This is quite a dire conflict, you might say, between separative notions and communal notions. And I would say we're all of us struggling with that because the paradigm, the model that's been imposed, you might say, or created in the minds of humans about how the world is meeting up with the fact that Mother Nature is saying, it ain't that way. You can't go on doing that. You can't rip out our heart and expect it to go on beating. And I mean, it really is a big deal. Now, when we were talking earlier, we switched over from the notion of whether you chastise or punish people or do you educate them. And the notion of walking the river, which is not an unusual notion. It's a wonderful thing. That's what got the Salmon River Watershed Roundtable off the ground and so successful, because people got out in the land and saw what's going on. Getting out on the land, being on the land, Brian, it forces you, if you like, in a gentle way, to have a perspective that incorporates the land.
Yeah, that really brings up a lot of different things. It's first of all, having a bit of tenure, having a bit of history there, to actually know what's going on. And by extension, I think that if we really value mentors and stop looking at things online, but actually talk to the people who have experience, it fixes another, not let people go off to pasture, but they have value. And you should be actually talking to people who have actually had that experience. So yeah, you can spend a lot of time, and you should do that before you start just go off the handle and start doing a project and then saying, oh, that was wrong. Maybe I should have thought about it before I started it, especially to do with nature. And so if we can involve the mentors a little bit, the elders, as it were, on the planning side of things and basically really just milk them for their mm-hmm. ideas.
Mm-hmm. No, I just want to focus on that because it's a return to the way, you might say, it's always been. And many Indigenous societies, and throughout everything we're saying today, there's a current of Indigenous principles and concepts and notions, which I think is because Indigenous cultures are embedded in the land. There's a kind of a false idea that you have to take the people out and never Mother Nature would be happy. No. People can have a really good relationship with Mother Nature, but this is such an essential concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Elder wisdom.
When you're farming, one of the first real lessons that you learn is that observation is key. And you can't learn from observation in a few days. You learn over years and over generations.
Well, if nothing else, Mother Nature is changing all the time, and so are our minds. You know, there's a lot of flux and flow back and forth. You've got to get
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I look at our trees as our mentors, for example. We're pruning fruit trees right now. Mm. And so every time we prune fruit trees, you look and you see, well, what happened last season? Mm. I can see where I cut something last season, and did that work or did it not work? And why did it work or not work? Mm. And I have a relationship with those trees that goes back from the time that I planted them. So the trees are teaching us, the water and the way that water works on the land is teaching us, and the people who have been there for generations can see those those changes and shifts and the effect of what we're doing and bring that knowledge forward.
I just can't stop the idea of family coming, bursting into my mind as you're talking about this. It's all about having a sense of family with more than just the human beings, but also with the other living elements of our world.
Well, I would like to say about the idea about nature changes, and a lot of times that it's seems like it's fighting us, but it's actually nature has been forced into that by what we've been doing. Mm-hmm. And so if we have flash floods and things, if we have forest fires, if we had all these kinds of things that happen, mm-hmm. he says, we're fighting ourselves. We're basically saying, okay, well, these things are happening, but not of their own volition. Mm-hmm. It's being forced by the, I guess, the presence of us and what
human,
we do.
And human hubris. Yes. The idea that we have it all figured out and we don't need, you know, Mother Nature is our servant rather than us being in this cooperative relationship.
And we should let it be the landlord.
Yes,
it has better rules.
The landlord. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and she doesn't charge money. She charges experience. You've got to take this in, boys. This is really, and girls, this is really happening. One of the things that one of you said, I don't remember which was before the show, was land is worth a lot, but it shouldn't be a lot of money.
That's right.
Do you remember who said that?
Yeah, well, I said it last time we were doing the pre-interview.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, it shouldn't cost a lot, but it is valuable.
Establishing a different relationship with the land when you have legal structures that are not designed to have that cooperative relationship, that's an issue. And we talked about that again before the show. Rebecca, what issues are in the way of having, well, the notion of a land trust, which is sort of establishing values beyond sheer financial. You talked about how hard it is to get that off the ground, something like this, because the law is just is not designed to make that happen.
Yeah. The law is designed strictly for private ownership. Mm-hmm. The concept of collective ownership has been disbarred in a lot of ways. There is really bizarre barriers, mostly around things like taxation, where if you try to give land into a land trust, you have to pay capital gains tax based on what somebody thinks is the market value of your land, as though you had sold it.
And
for
profit. When you hear the market value thing, these valuation of your property every year, and mm-hmm. it goes up or down, and you scratch your head and wonder why it went up or why it went down, because it doesn't have anything to do with your own personal affairs. And yet it is the dominant, you know, evaluation process. How much money is it evaluated by some arbitrary measurement?
Externalized measurement.
It's the commodification of land and shelter is problematic, and I think we're mature enough to get rid of that now.
You were asking about like the barriers to things like land trusts. Well, apart from the concept of this weird capital gains being attached to land, there's just also a really practical problem that for most farmers, again, going back to this idea of how much debt are people in? Well, farmers are in
a goodly amount.
A goodly amount, yes, shall we say. that the only value that they have, the only savings that most farmers have is the value of their land, the monetary value of their land. And so if you're there saying, well, I'd really like to do this, but I also would really like to not starve when I'm 80. I don't really want to live in a cardboard box on the street after, you know, four generations of trying to caretake land. And so what we've done is actually punish people for trying to farm. We punish people for attempting to put land into common ownership, common management. And we punish people for getting old. Also, that's another whole issue, though.
Our whole responsibility with water as well. Some altruistic type person decided that, hey, we're going to make sure that we don't have people wasting and taking far too much of their own share of water resources. So we're going to put together a water licensing, a water, what is the?
They call it the water management branch.
Yeah. So they're basically what they do is they charge people, like they fine people before the actual ruination of it.
When you have a water license, it's not, nominally this is about figuring out who's doing what in the watershed and therefore where the potential contamination can come or whatever, or just how much water is being
used.
Yeah. However, when you're being also assessed a monetary value for the water that you're being, that you're using, as Brian says, it's sort of a preemptive fine. If you use a lot of water, you pay a lot of money. The problem with that is not that people who use money have who use water have a responsibility to the watershed. The problem is that it's been, that the relationship is now based on money. And again, you were talking about the Salmon River watershed and walking the river. And I think Brian's going back to that idea that if we want to create relationships of responsibility, we need to not put money in between us and that relationship.
Yeah.
We need to actually reestablish the basis of that relationship.
It kind of neuters the relationship between you and the land, you and the food and the biota, you know, the living things that are all around us. It makes it seem like it's just a question of how much dollars goes this way or that way.
Exactly. It's again, a piece of that profound alienation that's at the depth of capitalism.
Yeah, and it bespokes to misinformation and uneducated ways of looking at how we, our relationship to water, instead of being a colonial capitalist way of looking at things, it presupposes that everything has, that's suited into a particular system. And we're saying, okay, well, that's a monetary thing. That's not a psychological thing that we have to look at.
It's not a matter of understanding or experience. It's a matter of, we're going to get fined. We better not do it without knowing why. Remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Brian McIsaac and Rebecca Neen, the owners of Crannock Ales and Left Field Farm. Along these lines, Oscar Wilde has a famous saying, which I'm sure you know. He said, "A fool is someone who knows the price of everything, but the value of nothing." And it's hard to not see how all of these concepts kind of coalesce. They probably were established as rules of life in indigenous societies all over the world because they were face to face with the natural world. They weren't one step removed in a high rise, office building in a large urban center talking about it. They were right on the land facing it. One of the things we talked about again before the show was one of my favorite ideas, which is the guaranteed basic income. And Brian, you said, well, I have a corrective for that. And the corrective was along the lines of what we're talking about in this immediate relationship between us and the reality of our lives, is the notion that instead of money, that people have guaranteed food and shelter.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We're talking about histories, and Brewster always had this notion, and Kathleen as well, about having a food card that was issued to people, that they would just, that would be part of their clawback from what the government takes from you. I'm just thinking about that whole thing about the guaranteed income.
The means of getting what they need, but it's still supporting the capitalist system.
But that's it also puts that interface that you were talking about earlier, the interface of money between you and the things that you need or want or which will help you survive.
And it individualizes the relationship as well, again. So it's you and your personal income and what you choose to do with your personal income as opposed to the common social...
If we're talking about safety nets and things, if we're going to work with that, I think that it's shelter and food should be off the table as far as commodification. I think that we should just be having people look after people who are looking after our food, make sure that they can do so in perpetuity without having to worry about mortgages and day-to-day living. They should have their needs taken care of as we take care of other people's needs with the food that they produce.
And, you know, it's often been shown, and I can think of some recent examples which were pretty egregious, that if you give people money and you say this is compensation for example, to Indigenous people for the colonial destruction of their culture. So at one point, I think the Harper government made this apology in Parliament and then gave people who had been harmed by the residential school system, which was most Indigenous people in this part of the world, a sum of money. And it was just a sum of money. And I thought that's a mixture of naivety and indifference. Well, indifference.
It also speaks to the whole notion of giving back. It presupposes that you take something in the first place. Hmm. And maybe we should just get to the don't take in the first place. Share.
What a novel idea.
Yeah. Start and it's being like good. All the corporate citizens that we're talking about say, well, they run these charity things and they say, well, we're just going to give back. I always hear it. And I go, what were you doing taking in the first place? You should just get to a point where you raise the society with you. If you're succeeding, then make sure that everybody is succeeding with you.
You know, assuming that everybody has to eat, which is as a physician, I can state clearly that's a solid concept, and also everybody needs shelter from the elements. You know, sometimes it's too hot, sometimes it's too cold, but
Goldilocks moments.
Yeah. It's very a whole string of Goldilocks moments. It seems to me that the advantage of what you were suggesting, Brian, over what I was thinking about was that it demonetizes these essential services for people. It says, do you need to eat? And if somebody says no, well, take them off to a museum and probably have a special
feed
exhibit.
Feed them that way.
Yes, right. So this idea of monetizing everything, turning everything into money, it's increasingly clear that that is a way of sort of insulating ourselves against reality. The fact that we need to eat, we need shelter, we need a community. How important a community is starting to become clearer to the capitalist world because everybody's talking about loneliness.
Well, it's a misunderstanding. It's a lowbrow kind of understanding of how things work if you just shove it over towards the capitalist. Having money for everything is what's important, and that's not what's important.
We were actually talking about food banks the other day.
Oh, yeah.
And the that food banks are, first of all, we know this is a Band-Aid solution. This is not really dealing
with
food
security. It's a sign
of
failure.
Exactly. But what if we all ate from food banks?
Mm-hmm.
And food banks were not the place where you put all the stale bread.
They're not a rescue place.
It's not a rescue place. It's actually where we all go to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So
how we function.
It's how we get our basic groceries. Mm-hmm. It's how we, and it's the place, possibly even a place where we might socialize. And so your basic need is being filled by people who are growing food and sharing that food. It increases it has the potential to increase everyone's participation in growing and raising food, even to a small extent. And again, it demonetizing the relationship, the base relationship with food. Not that it would be all our food necessarily. No, I think that might be a bit much of a stretch from this moment. You know, we've got to go through stages. But
it's something that we've actually been trying to work on for a very long time, is trying to make sure that we feed people in our society without charging them for that. So maybe it's not a bad thing, a food bank. If we looked at it a different way, we say, well, look, let's wholesale make everybody being able to access it.
Yeah, that treating everybody the same. What you're talking about is treating everybody the same. We're all human. We're all, you know, living. We have certain needs while we're alive.
Supply.
Yeah, exactly. Now, one of the fatal flaws in the capitalist system is it's based around a mythical concept, the concept of Homo economicus, which means economic man. First of all, it's man. Second of all, it is about money. In other words, the basis of the system is that all these people will be striving to get their own needs met, and their conflict with all the other people who are striving for that will balance out, and eventually everybody will get what they need or want. The trouble is, it is couched in terms of money and material goods. Every scrap of it is couched that way. And what we're talking about, the vision you guys are laying out is this vision that we start with making sure everybody has the basics, and then if there's excess, food grown, it can go to others. You know, you can have a luxury of a nice, really nice meal that you maybe has got food in it that you didn't grow on your own property or in your own space. It's kind of a lovely vision in a way, isn't it?
Well, also too, I would say that it's not the basics. Why not have people have a little bit more? And it's okay for when you don't just have people who need, if they get evacuated, the basics. Why not give them something more?
I think you're saying it's a lovely vision, and I think it's really important for us to have imagination.
Yeah.
One of the things that I feel has our current economic system and our current sort of emergency structures and context has done is that it has eroded our ability to imagine an alternative.
Yes.
When you try to talk about things like this, people say, well, that can't work. If we reject our own imaginations, mm-hmm. then we remain forever trapped.
Mm.
And we know imagination is, I think, one of our biggest strengths as humans.
Of course.
We can envision other ways of being. We really can. And I think we need to do that in order to be able to take the steps along the path to get there from here.
Yeah, we have this thing in republicanism about Irish republicanism that we see what we need to have happen and we start to plan for it. It's like if you have, like we had a good example of a gravel pit being up the way, say, so we should have some meetings on what are we going to do when it's gone, because it's going to be gone. That's what we're working towards. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to basically maybe have a fruition of ideas and paradigms that say, okay, well, we're going to have to plan for this because we're not going to have this other thing because we won't stand for it. Yeah. We will make sure that we have a future. And how does that future look? What are we going to do and how are we going to get there?
Do you, we're getting near the end of the show. Do you have a sense of change, after a quarter century, a full quarter century of operating? Do you have a sense of movement towards some of the ideas that we're talking about today, towards treating everybody as if they had the same needs and not making everything a question of money? Brian, you can go first.
Where does the future hold? I think that we are needing to mitigate things, and instead of reacting in negative ways about things, we shouldn't be competing to get things happening. We shouldn't retaliate, but we should try to work with people and listen to people, because I think that's what we wanted to get at, as well as is all things come from talking and communication with people to figure out why people are different from others and how we can educate people.
I think there is a change. I think people have started to be thoroughly fed up with a system that is constantly taking. And I think that we are starting to learn from the land. Being whacked over the head with giant climatic catastrophes has a way of making people sit up and take notice. And if there is an upside to that, it's that people are actually thinking about things differently.
You know, the two of you are a couple that puts paid to the notion that you marry for economic advantage. It's you married because of character and commitment. And, you know, I think at a certain level, that's what all of us as citizens, you know, whether we're married or not, need to do. We need to start saying character and commitment start the game and the ball rolling and, you know.
Married for principles.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, indeed. It's really been lovely to have you on the show again. And I'm sure it isn't the last time. And it was just delightful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.